Mission for the Blind. The date is April 15, 1972, and the subject is the Iowa Civil Liberties Union. Our interviewee today is Mr. Gilbert Cranberg, a member of the Board of Directors of the Iowa Civil Liberties Union and a member of the National Board of Directors of the American Civil Liberties Union. He lives at 427 51st Street here in Des Moines, and he is 46 years old. Well, I guess we could just start with some of the cases you've been active in your role in the Iowa Civil Liberties Union. How about the Amish case?
It was a case that arose because a number of families in an Amish community in Iowa objected to having their children taught by certified teachers, that is, teachers who were licensed by the state and had to meet the state licensing requirements for teachers, which meant they had to be college graduates. And these Amish feel that it's a violation of their religious convictions to be taught by such teachers. Their preference is to be taught by people who have much less worldly connections, and they want their children taught by teachers who have no more than eighth grade education, which is the standard that the Amish people go by for their own education. So they controversy developed over this, and the position that the Iowa Civil Liberties Union took in the case was that it was not an unreasonable requirement for the state to impose in order to attempt to guarantee a minimum educational standard for young people. And it felt in this conflict between the religious views of the Amish and the rights of young people to an adequate education, that the state could reasonably impose this requirement.
Mm-hmm.
And this led to a position that the Iowa Civil Liberties Union took was contrary to the position that the National American Civil Liberties Union took in this case. They felt that the emphasis shouldn't be so much on the formal training of the teachers, but rather on actually the kind of education the youngsters received. And they felt that rather than make the test whether a teacher was certified or not, how well do the youngsters perform? And the national organization proposed that the youngsters be permitted to have their teachers with an eighth grade education, but to test their performance periodically by tests.
Mm-hmm.
And this recommendation of the national organization ultimately was accepted by the legislature, and this was written into the state law. And I should say that the Iowa organization felt that this was merely a delaying thing, because it was felt, well, what if you find ultimately that the youngsters do not do well on the test? Then you're still confronted with this basic conflict, and you're not resolving it, really. And this position is proven to have had some merit, because the youngsters have been given the tests and they have not been performing well on the tests. And this question is often resolved, and the national organization is now again reviewing this problem in light of the results of the test.
Does it occur very often that there's a conflict between one of the affiliates and the national organization itself?
Not really very often. Most often what happens is not a conflict so much is that the affiliates go beyond what the national organization is prepared to do. The affiliates in many cases lead, and that they adopt positions that the national organization has not as yet adopted or has seen fit to adopt. And quite often the national organization will come around, that is, will adopt a position that an affiliate had espoused and had urged on the national organization. So this happens fairly often, where either the national organization has not taken a position, has remained silent in an area, or has been unwilling to go as far as a state affiliate has urges it to do, but then ultimately does come to adopt that position.
Mm-hmm. How about the draft card burning case? I know the ISW is active in this controversy.
Well, yeah, there were two draft destruction cases very early in when this was something of a bad, a way to protest. And one of these cases arose in Iowa, and another arose, I believe it was in Boston. And we took the Iowa Civil Liberties Union represented the young man in the Iowa case, and took the case as far as the Federal District Court, which is as far as he wanted it to go, because he subsequently agreed to abide by the court's finding of guilty, and he agreed to follow the probation conditions. But this other case, the Boston case, was the one that ultimately went to the U.S. Supreme Court, and where it was decided that Congress could properly make destruction of draft card a criminal offense.
Going back to what you said about the young man deciding to accept the court's decision, does it happen often that the union will find, what they feel is a violation of the civil rights, but they find it difficult to bring to court because of the participants' unwillingness to go to court? Does that happen often?
It happens occasionally. One case that comes to mind is a case of some young people who were threatened with expulsion from school because of the length of their hair, and we offered to represent them in court, and the youngsters wanted this representation, but because they were minors, it was necessary to have their parents approve, and the parents declined to give their approval, so we were blocked from going to court. This is not usually a problem, because most of the cases that come to our attention are from people who themselves feel aggrieved, felt that their rights have been violated, and they come to the organization asking for help. And it isn't too often that we come across a situation where there has been a violation of rights, and where we offer our services and people are not interested in accepting them. That has not happened often.
How about about the long hair? I know there's a case in Colfax concerning long hair. Could you elaborate on that?
Well, that was the first long hair case that was taken to a federal court in Iowa, and that was possibly the first and only case anywhere in the country that involved the length of hair of a girl. And the federal court ruled that the school authorities had no right to dictate the personal appearance of the student, and held that one's personal appearance is something to be determined by that individual as a matter of constitutional right. And we had hoped that this case would settle it in Iowa. Unfortunately, a fairly substantial number of school authorities just ignored the court ruling and continued to oppose these requirements. So we had to take several more cases to court. And at this time, I think that the school authorities are fairly well conforming to the court rulings now. At least we do not have any complaints to speak of from young people in schools. Most of the hair complaints now are coming from people who have run into problems with private employers.
Mm-hmm. Well, going into student rights a little bit more, I know the big moment came in the isolated history when the Tinker case was presented in front of the Supreme Court. Could you talk a little bit about that?
You know, this, we take in many cases to court, and but the Tinker case has been the only time that the Iowa Civil Liberties Union succeeded in getting a case up before the U.S. Supreme Court. And it proved to be a very significant case in the country as a whole. It determined a landmark ruling is overworked, but I think it does apply in this case because it established very clearly that the Constitution applies beyond the schoolhouse door, and that when a youngster enters school, he does not forego his rights to free expression. That is, he does not forego them if his conduct does not cause a disruption or disturbance in the school.
Mm-hmm. I'm kind of curious, how does an average case like come to the attention of the ICLU? Do the members, you know, scout around trying to find court cases that have been carried out unfairly, or how does the majority come to your attention?
Well, most of them probably come through from people who contact us. They have a particular problem. They either call or appear in person at the downtown office, or they write. Some issues that come to our attention from stories in the paper. Those are the chief ways we hear about problems.
Mm-hmm. Could you? You were telling me before about one particular case that came to your attention when you read a small article in the paper. Could you tell about that?
This seemed to be a routine story about a judge in a small town in Iowa who sentenced a bank robber to life imprisonment. And I wrote a little editorial saying that life imprisonment for bank robbery is a pretty severe penalty, and that it used to be the only penalty that for bank robbery, until a number of years ago the legislature changed the law and gave judges discretion to sentence to from 5 years to life. And since the change in the law, most judges had been sentencing to 25-year terms. Well, in response to the editorial, I had a letter from the judge saying that we were in error and that he had no option. He had to sentence this man to life imprisonment according to law, and he had not only sentenced this man to life imprisonment, he had recently sentenced two others. So upon checking into that, I found that he clearly was in error. The law had been changed. And so the Iowa Civil Liberties Union then represented these three men and succeeded in getting the sentences of two of them changed to 25 years of imprisonment and the third to a 35-year term. And on looking into the case, I found that it was possible for the judge to have made this error because none of the three had been represented by an attorney at the time of sentencing. They were entitled to lawyers, but when the judge told them of their right to an attorney, they simply said, well, I'm guilty and I'm going to waive my right to an attorney. An attorney can't do me any good. And when this was brought out, it made the legislature realize that people do not understand the value of having an attorney, and the feeling was they should not be allowed to waive the right to an attorney. And so a law was passed making it mandatory for the court to appoint attorneys in every felony case, so that no one can enter a guilty plea in Iowa without having
all this came about just because you happened to see an article in the paper.
Yes.
I was reading in the Registering Tribune files about a citizen complaint bureau that had been set up in Des Moines on Harding Road, I guess. Whatever became of that, and what was its purpose?
This was set up one summer about 2 or 3 years ago with some foundation money that the Iowa Civil Liberties Union has, a foundation which people can contribute tax deductible funds. And it was felt that there might be some problems in the Negro section of town around 13th University, and where people have problems with police or other government officials, and they are feel powerless and unable to cope with these problems. And we felt that if we had a representative there, we could get a feel of what these problems were. And so we hired a young black law student to, and he set up an office in the area to attempt to receive and investigate complaints of people in the area. And on the balance, we received a fair number of complaints, but many of them were not of a particular civil liberties nature. And it was felt that, on the whole, we could probably do more with our limited money by putting into other kinds of projects. Although this, our representative there was particularly helpful in one case of where there was a police shooting, a fatal shooting, and he was able to. There were a lot of rumors about whether the shooting was necessary and exactly what happened, and he was able to piece together a pretty complete and objective account of what did happen there. And this was probably the single biggest contribution that office made that summer.
Mm-hmm. Has there been a change in the trends of cases, the types of cases that come before the union? Like, you know, like maybe 10 years ago, I thought it was all pretty much black rights and, you know, pretty much standard things, but now has it changed more?
Yeah, it's always changing, and both at the national level and at the state level. There are, you know, some fairly staple kinds of things like, you know, free expression and things of that sort, and the right to attorney and those things. But a whole new areas about, like, welfare rights, for example. This was unheard of, say, 10 years ago, and the assumption was for many, many years that people who receive welfare receive charity, and they should be thankful for what they get, and they have no right to welfare benefits. Well, attitudes have changed considerably on that. There's been recognition that people should be treated fairly, whatever the circumstances, and that if you are eligible for the benefits, you have a right to receive them, and they cannot be cut off arbitrarily. You have a right to hearings in cases of disputed questions. You can't be denied welfare benefits because of residency rules, and a whole body of law has developed in the area of welfare rights, and these new areas keep developing, like prisoners' rights. The same sort of thing has happened, where people always felt, well, you're a prisoner, you're locked up, you certainly don't have any rights. But a whole body of law has been developing in the area of prisoner rights, and you're subjected to disciplinary proceedings in the prison. You have a right to due process in having that proceeding handled properly. And you have, emerging rights of access to newspaper reporters and rights to communicate with people outside the prison. So it's another whole new area. And this whole question of human rights is not a static thing, it's a very dynamic thing.
And I know also included in this list of new realizations would be, oh, saying homosexuals and the mentally ill too, their rights have become...
Right, people are coming to realize that because you are supposedly mentally ill, doesn't mean that that you can be shunted off to a mental hospital and just kept there and be denied treatment. That you, when you are committed to a mental institution, there are very many parallels with being committed to a penal institution. Your freedom of movement is severely curtailed, and that it's important that all the decisions involving the commitment what happens to you in the institution, that all of these things be surrounded by safeguards.
Didn't you yourself have a role in a mentally ill case, in the case of a man who's committed to prison?
Well, for many years, we had no facilities for handling people who presented security problems. That is, people who were sent to a state mental hospital and who were difficult to handle, possibly presented threats to others or presented a threat to escape. And the mental institutes were simply didn't have the facilities, the security facilities for these people. So what happened is that they were these people were transferred administratively to the ward for the criminally insane at the Anamosa Reformatory, which is a prison. And there are kept the people who had been convicted of crimes and who were considered dangerous. And so lumped into this one institution with people who were convicted criminals and people who had never committed any crime but who were just too difficult to handle at the mental hospitals. And they were all when you went to the institution, you couldn't tell one from another. They all wore prison uniforms. They all had prison numbers. They all had to conform to the rules of the penal institution in terms of visitors, writing letters to outsiders, and all the rest. And this was a just an absolute clear violation of the rights of the mentally ill. And the Iowa Civil Liberties Union brought a case in behalf of a young fellow who had been committed initially to one of the state mental hospitals, I think it was Independence, and who had been difficult to handle, and they transferred him to the Anamosa prison. And we succeeded in getting a court order compelling the state to release him from Anamosa and to put him back in the mental hospital at Independence. And there had been a fair amount of agitation up until this time to eliminate that ward for the criminally insane in the prison and to establish a security hospital. And this case was the thing that convinced the legislature that they couldn't fool around anymore, that they had about the money and to build a security hospital. And one has since been constructed, and it's now in operation at Oakdale.
In the national organization, I know there's been a split between the so-called traditionalists and activists, especially over the Vietnam War. Could you kind of go into that?
The Vietnam War caused a big rift in the country as a whole, and this was evident in the organization also. There were people who felt that this was a really critical problem in the country, and Civil Liberties Union should recognize it. And so there was a group that had campaigned very actively to get the organization to declare the war unconstitutional and to fight the war in various ways, opposition to the draft, and appeals for amnesty, and declaring the war unconstitutional. and also in the whole area of civil disobedience. People wanted the organization to come out in behalf of the people who were protesting the war in various ways, including the violation of laws in their protests. And so this triggered an internal dispute over a whole range of questions. And the organization took various positions on the draft, on amnesty, on the constitutionality of the war. As the war has ceased to become a matter of such central concern in the country, this split has receded, and the dividing line between activists and traditionalists that did seriously threaten to split the organization, this dividing line is much less evident, and at national board meetings, which I attend periodically, you can't tell how anyone is going to vote on any one issue, and there's much less evidence of camps, of an activist camp, a traditionalist camp. People just divide on how they have to view a particular issue.
What were you yourself doing this?
I would have been called a traditionalist. I opposed the position taken on the Vietnam War, and I opposed the position declaring the draft unconstitutional, and I didn't see how amnesty was a civil liberties question. The organization did take a very responsible position on the question of civil disobedience. This was a very big fight on this one. Some people wanted the organization to declare that civil disobedience, that is, the violation of a valid law, could be permissible under certain circumstances. And the organization refused to take that position, said under no circumstance is the violation of a valid law something that the civil liberties union would condone or defend.
Weren't you active in bringing a suit against Justice of the Peace Court? So was the ICLU active in this?
The Iowa Civil Liberties Union did bring a suit, and it also, I mentioned that the suit was instrumental in getting the legislature to change, to establish a new mental health institute. And this suit on the JPs also was similarly instrumental in getting legislative action. This suit challenged the practice of taking people who are charged with crimes to where the police could take them before any JP, and they customarily would take them before not the nearest JP, but the JP whom they felt would be most likely to find the fellow guilty. And the court agreed that this practice was unconstitutional practice, and the court ordered that from now on that people who are accused of crimes be taken before the nearest JP, and this helped make the legislature see the handwriting on the wall and realize that they're going to have to make some basic changes in the system, which the legislature has now done. It has abolished all of these minor courts now.
Has it become also more fashionable to be active in civil liberties unions now, like in the last 10 years now that, you know, the whole question of civil liberties has become kind of the thing to do, more or less?
Well, I think people are more conscious of it and of their stake in it, and young people, for example, now are more interested and more conscious of the rights of students, for example, the rights of high school people and college students. And so there's a greater awareness rather than being more fashionable. I think people are more concerned, and the membership of the national organization has increased appreciably.
Well, now the ICLU was active also on the big wiretap issue. What was going on with that exactly?
Well, in Iowa, there was a bill to legalize wiretapping by police, and the Iowa Civil Liberties Union was the only organization to testify against it when the bill was before the legislature. And the organization organized opposition to it and created a special committee, a lawyers committee, to oppose it. And this consisted of many prominent lawyers in Iowa, including former U.S. attorneys. And the group did carry a lot of weight in the legislature, and as a result, the bill just barely passed the Senate. And when it also passed the House, considerable pressure was put upon the governor on this issue, and he ultimately vetoed the bill.
As you're the National Board of Directors, you could probably give us some kind of an inside view of what goes on at a meeting of the National Board of Directors.
There are 80 members of the National Board. 49 of them represent the affiliates. The affiliates select their delegates to the National Board, and the balance are at-large members who are elected by the membership. I am one of the at-large members. And this group meets five times a year. Each meeting extends over 2 days, and there are two full days of discussions, and it's a policy-making group, and various positions that have been studied by the committees that the ACLU has. The committees make various recommendations to the National Board, and papers are distributed to the board members beforehand, and these policies are thrashed out.
Well, anyone can join by paying a membership fee, and anyone can become active by simply attending the board meetings or agreeing to work on committees. And people don't have to be lawyers to be knowledgeable or active. People develop different interests. Like Mrs. Nam, the chairman, has had a long interest in women's rights, and she's quite expert in this. One of our members is a former mental patient. He's developed quite an interest in the rights of the mentally ill, and some of our black members have particular interests in questions of equal educational opportunity and things of that sort.
How did you yourself become involved in the ICLU?
Well, I just had a long interest in questions of constitutional law and rights of the accused, and I've written quite a bit in this area, and it was just seemed natural to get involved with the organization because the organization is so deeply involved in problems in these areas.
Well, this has been very informative. I'd like to thank you very much for the interview.
Today's interview is sponsored by the Public Library of Des Moines and the Iowa Commission for the Blind. Today's date is Saturday, April 15, 1972. The subject we will be discussing today is the Iowa Civil Liberties Union, and we will be interviewing Mrs. Louise Now, who lives at 3131 Fleur Drive, age 64. Okay, now, Mrs. Now, could you tell me how and when you first got started with the Iowa Civil Liberties Union?
Well, I can't tell you exactly because I belong to the Iowa Civil Liberties Union, which is a branch of the American Civil Liberties Union, for, I suppose, a number of years. It was just an organization that I believe was doing good work, and it was a cause in which I was interested in. And so I was simply a member who made an annual contribution, and that was my entire involvement with the organization until I was asked to run for the board. First year, I was put up for, my name was on the ballot for a member on the board. My name was misspelled, and it turned out to be the name of my brother-in-law, who didn't get elected. But the second time around, the following year, I did get elected. So I suppose that was the beginning of my active participation in the Civil Liberties Union. The first thing I ever did for the Civil Liberties Union was to edit the bulletin. Don Murphy, who was an editor of Successful Farming and a longtime and staunch member of the Civil Liberties Union, had always edited the bulletin, and he wasn't very well, and he just called me up one day and he said, "Louise, you've been appointed editor of the bulletin." And I said, "I don't know anything about editing a bulletin," but with his help, I did. I looked at that bulletin today. It was dated November 1963. And among the items in the bulletin is the fact that the membership was growing. Now, this is 1963. The latest count was 540 members. And it announced that this was a percentage rise of 47% for the fiscal year. The Iowa Civil Liberties Union today has about 1,200 members. So you can see that from probably 300 members in 1962, it's grown to 1,200 members in 1972. And the Iowa Civil Liberties Union, along with the American Civil Liberties Union, has witnessed a very large growth in the last 10 years, not only in numbers, but in the quality and the quantity of their program. The income reported at the annual meeting in May of 1963 against the same bulletin was, for the year, $1,738. Last year, the Iowa Civil Liberties Union had an income, which is shared with the ACLU, of over $20,000. I think maybe it was near $22,000. So again, this is indicative of the growth of the organization in the last 10 years. It was sometime after that, I can't even give you the date, 64 maybe or 65, that I was elected chairman of the ICLU. I went into the organization very hesitantly. I mean, went into the chairmanship because I wasn't a lawyer. I had no expertise in the field of civil liberties. My schooling had been strictly in the humanities. I was a history major in college, and after college I did graduate work in art history and trained to be a museum director. And so you can see that this was a field that I really didn't feel easy in at all, being able to express myself, although I felt deeply about the issues. But with promise of help from other board members who had been in working in civil liberties longer, I did take over, and I didn't realize that it would get to be an annual thing for a number of years. But this is my last year I rotate off the board. But it's been an exciting number of years for me. We've been involved in many kinds of cases and all kinds of interesting issues, and certainly it's been a tremendously educational process for me. I've learned just all kinds of things. The Iowa Civil Liberties Union depends on volunteer lawyers to take their cases, and of course this limits very much what we can do, because while lawyers may take cases where they investigate something, take a long and complicated case, it just takes a lot of time, and a busy lawyer, or most busy lawyers, are just not going to give the time to do it. Along the way, I thought, in order to remedy this situation and to have a full-time lawyer for the Civil Liberties Union, I would become a lawyer. So about 5 years ago, I guess, I enrolled in Drake Law School and stayed one semester. I learned the hard way, something that I had always said was not true. I said, "It's never too late to go to school." Well, I learned it was. I was a completely new field, and getting to an 8 o'clock class every morning and all the rest, it was just more than I could cope with. So I did stick it out. I took my exams and got my credit for the work I'd done that semester. And then I said I didn't drop out. I just collapsed. So that was the end of my legal career. However, it did give me really a feeling of assurance in talking about legal things. I thought I had some background, and just for my general job as chairman of the Civil Liberties Union, I think it really, that semester, while traumatic for me, was also very helpful. The first case after I became chairman, and the first law case, I guess, that we Civil Liberties Union has had in a number of years, was concerned with the rights of patients in mental institutions. Iowa at that time had no mental security hospital. This was in 1965. And patients who were considered that they couldn't keep in the mental hospitals because of they considered them security risks in many ways, were sent to the penal institution of Anamosa, and were really under the same rules and regulations and the same physical conditions as the prisoners there. So we defended a patient who had been transferred to Anamosa, and the judge ruled that it was unconstitutional for the state of Iowa to transfer a patient from a mental institution to the mental health security hospital at Anamosa. This, the newspaper headline in connection with the story, I might say that the reason I'm so versed in many of these things I'm going to talk about this afternoon is because I've been looking over old clippings and making some notes this morning. And the newspaper headline in connection with that story was "Security Hospital Now a Must." And in fact, the legislature was spurred on by this decision to appropriate money to build a security mental hospital for Iowa, mental patients in Iowa.
Mrs. Mound, earlier you mentioned that you were attracted to the Iowa Civil Liberties Union and the American Civil Liberties Union because of the types of things that they were doing. You already told us about the rights of mental patients. Can you tell us more what specifically these two organizations do for people?
Well, the American Civil Liberties Union, and as I say, the Iowa Civil Liberties Union is a branch of the ACLU. The purpose is to defend individual rights under the, as defined by the Bill of Rights of the United States Constitution. This goes into all areas of freedom of speech, freedom of association, rights of servicemen, generally the separation of church and state, these broad issues. And the Civil Liberties ACLU over the years, of course, has been involved in many important cases, beginning, they were the famous Scopes trial in Tennessee. They defended the teacher who was fired for teaching the
theory of evolution.
And the Ulysses case, when the United States Customs Office barred, who's the author? Ulysses. I'll think of it after a while. But anyway, this is a famous American classic that was barred by the Customs, and the Civil Liberties Union got a reversal on that case. They defended, or they attacked Mayor Haig, who was a famous city boss in Jersey City, when he issued an order that there couldn't be any public meetings in the city without his permission, or the permission of the city. The ACLU was instrumental in establishing the rights of conscientious objectors, and in they worked hard in the 50s in defending the rights of labor to organize. And in the last 10 years, the ACLU, along with the ICLU, has been active in defending rights of minorities and of groups which haven't been given full recognition of the rights in our society, particularly the rights of blacks, the rights of other ethnic groups, the rights of women, and the rights of students.
Mr. Cranberg said that you were quite an expert on the rights of women. Could you briefly tell us your experience with women's rights and your knowledge of women's rights?
Well, if you want to know most of what I want to know about women's rights, you have to read my book, Strong-Minded Women, which was published by Iowa State University Press several years ago, which is the history of the women's rights movement in Iowa, not of the women's rights movement, of the women's suffrage movement.